Amen. Thanks very much. Okay, just a little review, and what I wanted to do is kind of put in the context here of the book as a whole. It's always helpful in understanding what we're studying. And by the way, since we're now getting along to where we're several lessons into the fall study, the review for the next few weeks, I'm going to have to restrict myself to the more recent things. So this is the last time I'm going to point this out for a while, chapters 1 to 27 and 28 to 49. So I'm counting on you to remember them this time. So Isaiah 1 to 27 says a blank will blank. A remnant will return. All right, very good. And that refers to what? What's the remnant? Now, here's where we're going to separate the Isaiah experts from the Isaiah amateurs. There's two different things he means by that. Remember, there's two different remnants that Isaiah's prophesying about. One's a physical remnant, meaning the nation of Israel or Judah, who was going to be taken captive to Babylon, but then God was going to let a remnant of them come home and start over. What's the spiritual application of the remnant? Believers, Christians, people who will accept God, God's word, God's Messiah, a remnant out of all the people of the world will return to God. Okay, that's what the foundation of the book of Isaiah is teaching us that a remnant will return. That's always been what God's looking for, is seeking out a remnant from the world that basically doesn't believe and bringing it back to Him. Okay, Isaiah 28 to 49, the theme there is the sure what for your what?
Foundation.
Sure foundation. All righty, very good. For what? Your house, your bank accounts, for your times or for your lives. Either one is good. In other words, God is the one and only sure foundation on which to build. The lengthy discussion that Isaiah has contrasting God with idols. This last portion that we're studying this fall, and this one you'll hear a few more times, but there's no reason why you can't learn it right away. It says, arise, blank, for your blank has come.
Shine.
Okay, very good. And then what would go with shine?
Light.
Very good. All right. So now you're going to remember this from now on, right? Because I'm not going to be able to go over this every week because we're getting too much of the new stuff. So now you know, Isaiah 1 to 27, the theme is remnant will return. In the middle of the book, a sure foundation for your times. And then the last part tells us, arise, shine, for your light has come. So now if anyone ever stops you on the street and asks you to give them a quick outline of the book of Isaiah, you'll know what to do, right? Well, now as a matter of pure practicality, if anyone ever does stop you on the street and demand that you give them an outline of the book of Isaiah, I would recommend backing away and looking for a policeman. But you at least will know, if you do feel like answering the question now, you'll know, right? So that's good. So we got you prepared. Well, that's what this last part of Isaiah is talking about is, with these other things in mind, Isaiah is now saying, okay, we know a remnant's going to return. We know God is the sure foundation for your times and your lives. So this last part is exhorting us and encouraging us to arise, shine, for your light has come. In other words, here is what God has in mind for you. Here is what matters. Here is what you really need. So arise, shine, realize that it's light. Let that light shine. Let it reveal things to you that you need to know and that you want to know. The lesson we did a couple weeks ago, chapter 50 and 51, Isaiah says, lift up your eyes to the heavens. And the reason he says this is because most of the time, where are our eyes? What are we usually looking at? Some of you go around looking at the floor. That's right. That's for sure. I know a lot of people that go around looking at the floor all the time. In fact, there's a little professional joke about mathematicians since I work down at the math department. Down at Ohio State, they always say, how can you tell an extroverted mathematician from an introverted mathematician? Well, the extroverted mathematician looks at your shoes when he's talking to you. Okay. Those of you who aren't always looking at the floor, where are you looking at? Yourself, other people, the things going on in this world, the football team, the elections, the economy, your car that you want, the money that you have. In other words, we always got our eyes fixated on this world. And that's true whether you're looking down or parallel. We're always looking at this world. And it's very natural that if you're always looking at this world, what kind of a perspective are you going to develop?
Worldly.
A worldly perspective, exactly. And that's what Isaiah's telling us to do when he says, lift up your eyes to the heavens. He's saying, try to pull your eyes off of this world. Try to pull your attention and your focus out of all the things that they're arguing about and upset about and worried about, and look beyond this world and see that there's a spiritual reality, a spiritual world that really dwarfs this world in importance and really dwarfs this world in its permanence. And that's what Isaiah is saying, that to understand and appreciate what God wants to give us, we can't be looking just in this world to find satisfaction and to find fulfillment. We've got to look up, because this is what God's whole purpose is with us, is to help us to learn things that are not just a benefit in this world, to give us blessings that are not just a benefit in this world. If that's all God does is to try to make our lives a little better, to try to make this world a little bit better, that's what Isaiah says, it's too small of a thing. It's a trivialization of God if we're only worried about making things a little bit better right now. Because no matter what else happens, no matter how good a life or how bad a life you have, whether you're one of the people who's going around exploiting other people or whether you're one of the people that's always getting exploited, your biography will end the same way. You're going to die. And you're going to have to go before God. And you're going to be judged by God based on the man he has chosen, according to Acts 17, which is Christ. So God is interested in giving us a purpose and a meaning that transcends the things of this world. God is very well aware of the bad things that happen down here. He's very well aware of our weakness and our fear. And what he wants to do is answer those in a way that lasts a lot longer than just fixing up a few things in our temporary lives. And in fact, the passage that we looked at last week, Isaiah says, depart, depart, go out from there. Now, what does there mean? Is it room 44? Does Isaiah say, get out of there, that guy's crazy, he's going to fill your mind with weird thoughts, get out of here while you still got time?
It's where you are.
It's where we are in this world, exactly. In other words, he's saying, leave this world behind. Now, he doesn't mean physically, does he? What does he really mean?
Spiritually.
Spiritually. He means pull yourself away, tear your heart away from the things of this world that you're so fixated on, and learn to embrace something that's more permanent, more lasting, more spiritual. That's what he's talking about. And therefore he says, if we look back at some of the passages we studied last week, back in chapter 51, verse 7, he says, hear me, you who know what is right, you people who have my law in your hearts. Do not fear the reproach of men or be terrified by their insults. He has told us that as believers in an unbelieving world, we are this word right up here, a remnant. Now, what does a remnant mean? It's what's left over, right? And now there again, I'm going to trust you from now on, you'll know that and you'll remember it. Because he says, by nature, if you're a believer, if you really do rejoice in knowing God's will, if that's really the most important thing to you, you're part of a remnant. You're part of the leftovers, meaning that you're part of a minority. You're part of a small portion of this world who has embraced the purpose of returning to God, who has chosen that the things of the next life, the things of eternity, are more important than things of the world. And the fact is, as Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7, there's a broad road and a narrow road. And who's on the broad road?
Everybody.
Everybody. And where does it go? Destruction. So we want to be on the narrow road, so we have to be ready for that. True Christianity is never going to be a societal norm. When people talk about we live in a Christian society, they mean in a very superficial sense. They mean in a nominal sense. They don't mean in any genuine sense. Because real Christians, real believers, are always going to be a remnant, a minority, people who don't just use Christianity for worldly ends, but who realize that Christianity is the truth. It is what really matters, and who really live it. You know, the people who are nutty enough actually to believe that everyone is truly equal. The people who are nutty enough to believe that material things can't bring you happiness. That's a remnant. And the world does think when you believe that stuff, as opposed to just saying it, because you know what you're supposed to say, when you actually believe that stuff, the world's going to think that you're a little bit strange, and it's going to make them uncomfortable, and they will reproach you, and they will hurl some insults at you. And this is why Isaiah says this. He says, "You hear me, you who know what's right." You already know what's right, but it's not just a matter of knowing what's right. It's a matter of living what's right, is what God's answer. Because knowing what's right, we can sit there safe and sound in our home and say, I know there's a God. I know that there's more important things than the material stuff and the things going on. That's not hard, is it? What's hard is to get out there and live it. Because that's when you run into some difficulties with some of the other people who really are determined to live for this world and to be more selfish and self-centered. Well, Isaiah then has this series. He says, chapter 51, verse 9, just kind of keep a finger there and look down at then verse 17 and kind of keep those in mind, and then look at the first verse of chapter 52. And you'll see what you might call a common thread there. Isaiah gets a little bit redundant, doesn't he? What does he say? Awake, awake. In other words, what does God know that we need to do? God knows that most of us are just as stuck in this world as everyone else. We're just as fixated on material things, on worldly events. We're just as worried and panic-stricken as everybody else is about the horrible things going on. So what do we need to do about it? He says we need to wake up. In other words, this is one of the things that we sometimes don't realize how basic but how important it is on our relationship with God. Is to have a relationship with God, you don't have to go out and perform some great feat of sacrifice. You don't have to undo all the bad things that you've done. You just have to wake up. Realize, hey, wait a minute. There's more important stuff than the things that these pagans are so fixated on. There's more important things to worry about, and there's a better way to live. I don't have to be selfish. I don't have to push other people around. I don't have to compete with everybody. I just need to wake up. And then there's another phrase. He only uses this really once, chapter 52, verse 2. But he's got another phrase that basically means the same thing. Shake off the dust. Now, when he says shake off your dust, he implies that you've got some dust on you. Now, how do you get a bunch of dust on you? By sitting still for a long period of time, right? You know, if you sit still long enough, you're going to be covered with dust. Well, here again, if you kind of wake up one day and realize, hey, I'm covered with dust, what do you have to do to get rid of all that dust?
Move.
Just start moving, that's right. That's all it is. See, there again, so many times when people feel convicted, you're right. I really have been stuck on this materialism and selfishness of the world, and I'm worrying about stuff that they're worried about. Boy, I'm gonna have to do something. I mean, what am I gonna do? I mean, is there a class I can take someplace? I mean, is there someone who will spank me enough times to make up for it? Can I just give away a lot of money? Can I go running around and doing stuff? Well, what does God say? Just wake up, shake off the dust, and get moving. Because as soon as you start moving, what happens to the dust? Well, number one, it falls off, and number two, it stops accumulating. That's all that God wants. That's why we say we're saved by grace. Because not only is the physical application true that the dust starts falling off, what God will do is he'll start brushing that dust off for you. And this is what the Bible calls good news. This is why he says that how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. Chapter 52, down in seventh verse, how beautiful on the mountain are the feet of those who bring good news. Because this is the real good news about Jesus, is yes, indeed, we've all gotten ourselves caught up in worldly things, but the good news is, because God knows that you can't make up for it yourselves, God will give you the grace that you need if you are willing to make that change. So this is why he says, depart, depart, go out from there. This is down verse 11. Touch no unclean thing. Come out from it and be pure. This is why he says, so come on out. And again, he doesn't mean that you have to bail out of this world, go build yourself a shack on the moon or something so that you're no longer corrupted by the world. Doesn't mean you got to retire to a monastery someplace. In fact, Isaiah's already said many times, where does God want us once we have woken up? He wants us right here because he wants us to be what?
Light.
Well, what's this right here? Wants to be a light. And he says that, this is maybe hard to remember, but he also says you will, several times earlier in Isaiah, he says you will be a light and a covenant. That you will be a living light and a living covenant to show people that there's better things to focus on, there's a better way to live than the worldly way of life, worrying about what kind of possessions and power and authority and popularity we've got down here. And this is what he means. When he says, go out from there and be pure, he doesn't mean that you gotta isolate yourself from the world. He says you have to let your mind, your heart, your life reflect the real light. No longer the dim and dusk of the world, but be a light and be a covenant. And an interesting thing that closes out this chapter, when he says that you've got to make this change, it's time to wake up, here again, it's not a demand from God, a petulant, screaming demand that you've got to just do this right away, and if you don't, I'm going to smack you around some more. God understands that it's tough. God understands that it's difficult. He understands that it's very hard to adjust your mind because you spend all day long around people who are fixated on worldly things. You turn on your news, they fill your mind with lies and garbage about the world. They fill your mind with fear. They fill your mind with competition. The world's always going to do that. It's hard. But down in verse 12, God says, you will not leave in haste or go in flight. In other words, you don't have to do a mad scramble that this very day, this very afternoon, you got to straighten out all the things that you're wrong about and you got to clear your mind of everything. No longer ever again make the slightest entanglement with the world or compromise with the world. He says, I know it's going to take some time. And then look at this promise that he makes at the end of the verse. What does he say?
God of Israel will be your rear guard.
That's right. He says, the Lord's going to go before you. He's going to be your rear guard. In other words, in more contemporary language, he's got your back. But God knows it's going to be difficult for you to tell the world you're no longer going to let it dominate your way of thinking. You're not going to worry about the things that the world's thinking about anymore. You're just not going to do it. You're not going to treat people the way the world treats people. You're not going to compete with people and argue with people anymore the way the world does. You're going to accept that there are better things to think about and more important things to think about and better ways to live. And God is going to be there behind you to give you the protection that you need. Because he knows how hard that is. He knows that trusting in a God who does not reveal himself tangibly, does not give us something we can actually see or hear in a physical sense, he knows that's hard. And that's why he says so much of the time, that's what he's looking for, is faith. He's not looking for us to prove to him that we're great people and we're better than somebody else and we're more zealous than somebody else, because he knows we're not. We're not any better than anybody else. We're not any more zealous than anybody else. What he asks for is faith. Trust me, believe in me. I got your back. Here's what I want you to do. Trust me, believe in me. Here's what's good for you. Here's what I'm going to give, it's good for you. What the world's going to give you, it may sound exciting, may sound good, but it's no good for you. Trust me. That's what he's looking for. Because see, that's something we all can do. And that's something that's equally challenging for all of us. None of us is born with a natural disposition to seek an unseen God. We're all born with the same fleshly disposition to seek things of this world. Some of us are certainly more or less skilled in acquiring the things of this world, but that doesn't matter because that's not what God's interested in. It's an equal challenge for everyone to have true faith, to have genuine faith in the God of eternity, the God of Jesus, the God of grace. It takes a lot of faith to accept the fact that it is truly by grace. We're all very skilled at saying, oh yeah, I'm saved by grace, and then turning right around and assuming that what it really depends on is knowing the right things and going to church enough times and so forth. To really trust God, to really understand that we cannot save ourselves even 1%, that takes a lot of faith. And that's no easier for anybody else. It's just as much of a challenge for everybody else. So he says to come out of the world, again, speaking spiritually, to pull your focus away from the world. Remember what Jesus said, where your treasure is, there your heart's going to be also. Because once we change our focus and realize what's really important, then our heart can go right along with it. But we have to have that willingness to wake up first. Now in chapter 52, the last part here, and then all of chapter 53, it talks about the servant, the Messiah, Jesus. You're going to see a lot of things in here that you'll recognize right away. but it's talking about Jesus. But what Isaiah is saying is, if you really want to appreciate Jesus, you really want to appreciate the Messiah, it's only going to come if you look at it from the right perspective. Because the world considers Jesus to be, you know, a nice guy, good moral teacher, a real good source of program ideas around the holidays. You know, a lot of things that make this life maybe a little bit better, or give you a little bit of variety in this life. And that's not all what he came to do. And if we just look at Jesus that way, we're not going to appreciate the things about him that really stand out and the things that matter. We have to realize what he's trying to give us is things that they really do meet our deepest needs, but they don't necessarily meet our strongest desires. There's a big difference there. It's like, I remember I told you one of the things that, in the little complex where Linda and I live, one of the things we always have a controversy about there is all the goose droppings on the sidewalk. Some people get really worked up about that. Now, I admittedly am at an extreme. Anything that involves animals or nature or anything like that, I'm an extreme, because I'm very strongly pro-goose. To me, the aesthetic value of having the geese around more than makes up for having a few droppings on the sidewalk, because you just hose them off and you're on your way anyway. But a lot of my neighbors get very wound up about this. They get very emotional about something that needs to do something about these geese. You know, someone needs to do something. Well, after I told you this, a few days ago, some of our neighbors had their grandkids over. And while they were walking around outside, some of the geese came up, just honking and flapping their wings and that. And so the grandparents shoot them away. Get away, get away, get away. And their little granddaughter said, "Don't hurt the geese. They're God's creatures, and we should appreciate them." Amen. Preach it, sister. All right. But see, it's just a question of, do you really stop to think of things that way? Now, there again, you don't have to be pro-goose like me. The point is the perspective. Is that what really bothers you, is goose droppings on your sidewalk? Can you honestly look at your life and the world around you and think that that makes the top 10 list of things that someone needs to deal with? Because if you do, I would suggest one of two courses of action. Either you get down on your knees and you praise God for hours and hours for how easy and comfortable your life is, that a little inconvenience like that even makes a difference, or wake up and realize there's some real problems out there and go do something about them and stop picking on the geese, because they're harmless, they're not doing anything. And in particular, I always like to point out to my neighbors, geese really, Canada geese especially, they're all the things we're supposed to admire. Canada geese are absolutely faithful and monogamous in their relationships. Geese mate for life. If their mate dies, they will never again mate with anybody else. They will just devote themselves to looking after other people's chicks and helping the group. They are completely non-competitive. They are completely non-hierarchical. Nobody is ever in charge of a group of geese. They all just share everything. They share everything they have. And they're absolutely non-violent. They don't even eat bugs or anything like that. They just eat vegetation. Now, those are all things that we're taught from God's point of view, how we're supposed to feel about those things. Those are all good things. Those are all things we're supposed to admire. But as Americans, we're taught to be very suspicious of people who live that way. So as Christians, we're taught that those are very good things. But as Americans, we're taught to say, "What do you mean they're nonviolent? What do you mean nobody's in charge? What do you mean they don't compete with each other? Sound like a bunch of communists to me." Well, there again, if you want to appreciate Jesus, you've got to set aside all the things that have been instilled in you by this world. You just have to say, okay, I know I've been brought up to believe this, that, and the other, but I'm going to compare it with what God really says, because God's perspective is very different. Now, what I want to do is read this whole passage, because it really has a lot of ideas that fit together. And so I'm going to start here in verse 13, and if I can get a little help here. Norma, could you read chapter 52, 13 to chapter 53, 3. Who else has their Bible nearby here? Nancy, you willing to?
Not today.
Not today. Okay, well, that's a promise for next week, right? You got it there, Frank?
Which one do you want me
to use? Could you pick up in chapter 53, verse 4, after Norma's done, and then go down to verse 9.
Okay.
And
where
then
do I start, Mark?
Chapter 52, 13, and go down to 53, 3. And then, Frank, if you can go from verse 4 to 9. And then I'm going to get my ace closer, Doc, to finish out the passage here. Could you run the anchor lap here, Doc, with chapter 53, 10 to 12?
"See, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted.
Just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any man, and his form marred beyond human likeness. So he will sprinkle many nations, and kings will shut their mouths because of him. For what we were not told, they will see, and what they have not heard, they will understand. Who will believe our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He has no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. Like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not.
Surely he took up our infirmities and carries our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that has brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and afflicted, and yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked, and with the rich in his death, though he hath done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth.
Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and to cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, by his righteous servant, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquity. Therefore I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death, and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors.
All right, excellent, excellent reading there. Now, when you listen to that passage being read, and I want to read it in entirety so you can catch the whole thing, what's the main idea that jumps out at you? What do you think it refers to?
Jesus.
Yeah, you can't help but be drawn to that conclusion, even if you've never heard it before. Look at all the things it says about Jesus. What did you notice in there?
That he didn't answer back.
He didn't answer back when he was accused.
He was beaten beyond recognition.
He beaten beyond recognition, had an appalling appearance. Carried our transgressions, was crushed for our iniquities. Obviously, one of the crucial things that he came to do. Talks about how he did nothing in his appearance that we should desire him, despised and rejected by men, and yet raised up, lifted up, exalted by God. And then talks about after the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. In other words, there's a great deal there. Now, a lot of this is certainly very valuable from a purely prophetic point of view. Just knowing here is what God's servant Messiah was always meant to do several hundred years before he came. So there's a dimension to that that's very encouraging, just as prophecy, knowing that God planned it, knowing it happened exactly the way that God wanted it. There's another dimension, though, that we often miss, where it really tells us about Jesus from more than a factual point of view. So just was going to point out some things to look for. A lot of the things in this passage talk about the servant Messiah or the servant Christ. They also set an example for the servant of the Lord in a general way. The nature of the Messiah is, as we're told often in the New Testament, also supposed to be an example for us. To consider his example so that we may follow him in his steps. As he bore our iniquities, we are also supposed to bear the ills and the sins of the world upon us. It also teaches us some of the cornerstones of understanding our relationship with God. So there's really a lot going on here, and it certainly is very good to remember this passage when you're talking about the prophecies about the Messiah and the things that God had foretold. This is obviously a very valuable passage. It's also an extremely valuable passage for understanding the ministry of Jesus. Because it's one thing to believe that he came and to accept the fact that he was predicted and sit back and take satisfaction in the fact that we're actually believing the truth as opposed to some of the other religions people have made up. But is that all that God really is looking for? Well, no. He's looking for a lot more than that. He's looking for us to... Now, there again, I went and erased it with this nuclear-powered eraser here. But he's looking for us to rise, to shine, to realize that our light has come. Jesus came and was prophesied about for more than just for us to sit back and take satisfaction that God proved what he was going to do. God's calling us to a response. God's calling us to faith. God's calling us out of the world to be part of his remnant. So this passage is just as valuable in understanding Jesus. So if we go back up to the beginning here, if you notice at the beginning of chapter 53, Isaiah has this kind of rhetorical question to God. He says, who has believed our message? In other words, he's saying, does anyone out there really believe in this? Is anyone out there paying any attention? Now, we felt that way, right? You look around at the things that happen in this world and things that so-called Christians even do, and you wonder, does anybody out there really believe this at all? Well, of course, a lot of people feel that way. A lot of Christians believe that way. A lot of sincere Christians believe that way. So what is Isaiah asking that question for? Is he saying, if nobody believes it, I'll just pack up and go home and don't have to worry about this anymore? Well, you know that doesn't sound quite right, does it? No. He's saying, God, this is really hard down here, isn't it? And God is saying, yes, I know. That's why I call it the remnant. That's why I don't call it the majority. That's why I don't call it the norm, because he knows it's going to be difficult. But what Isaiah is called to do is to do what? To keep telling it, exactly. To keep telling it. If nobody's listened so far, is that a reason to quit? No, it's a reason to keep telling it, because it's important. And there again, it's a question of perspective, because if our expectation is, well, if I hit on the right method, enough people will respond to it. And that's how I'll know that I'm doing the right thing. And that's exactly the opposite of what God has told us. Because no, that's not any judgment at all. If we take a few rudiments of Christianity and package it up with a lot of worldly attractions, you'll actually get a lot more response than if you teach the truth. And so that's why a lot of churches don't preach the real Christ. They preach a health and wealth Jesus, or they preach a fun-loving Jesus, or they preach a capitalist Jesus, or some other thing. And the excuse is always the same. People won't go for that suffering servant stuff. People aren't going to go for that man of sorrows stuff. And that's we have to do God's work. You know, we have to save people's souls, and we're not going to do it by preaching the man of sorrows. But that's not really the real problem. The real problem is that we don't like the man of sorrows. We don't want the suffering servant. That's the real problem. It's not that we just want something better to entice people to come to our church. It's that we're awfully uncomfortable with Jesus as a man of sorrows. We're awfully uncomfortable with him being crushed for our iniquities. We don't really accept the fact that we needed anybody to be crushed for our iniquities. We really think that given the chance, I could just pay off my debt myself somehow. And we really don't want to live as Jesus did. We really want to convince ourselves that what Jesus was really all about was having a good time and making this world a little bit better place and not sweating the really bad things that happen too much because you can't do anything about them anyway. That's what we really want to believe. And we use the excuse a lot of times, well, the world won't buy that stuff. Well, no, it's because we don't buy it. We don't like it. Now, this is where God is looking for what? He's just looking for faith. He's not looking for you to say, okay, I can go do that. It's easy. No problem. I'll live like Jesus did. I'll let people crush me and kick me around. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, you got to start by accepting it in your heart. Yeah, that's the way that it really is. All the propaganda and all the marketing group formulated Jesus's, that's just fraud. What really is going on, he really came to be crushed for our iniquities, to call me to live for something higher this world. It's as hard for me as it is for you. It's as hard for you as it is for anybody else. Not easy for anybody. But if something's difficult and you refuse even to try to do it, what does it become? It becomes impossible. If you don't do something, it doesn't matter whether it's easy or hard, because if you don't do it, it's impossible. So what God is saying is just accept this, understand it. I know it's hard, I know you're not going to do it very perfectly, but understand this is what I want. I want someone who understands that there are more important things than the things of this world. He says, my servant's going to act wisely. Now, wisely from whose perspective?
God.
A lot of things that Jesus did were not too wise from the world's point of view. You remember his brothers and the way that they kind of took it to advise him? You got a good thing here going, big brother. You can do these miracles and you're a public figure and you're a great speaker. So, hey, let us tell you how to, let us be your manager here. If you're going to be a public figure, here's what you got to do. You got to do this, that, and the other. This is John chapter 7, if you don't recognize the reference. And Jesus said, you guys don't get it. I'm not here to be a public figure, to become famous, to become powerful and authority so that I can do a lot of good things for everybody. So I came here for a very different reason. So he's not going to do the things that are wise from this world's point of view. Remember when he was tempted by the devil? He could have had all kind of great things in this world. That's not what he came for. Well, you and I have the same opportunities before us. The world offers you a lot of rewards. There's always a price to be paid. There's no such thing as a free lunch. There's always some price to be paid, even if it's intangible. The intangible prices are usually ones that are most expensive in spiritual terms. A lot of things you can get, you may not have to pay for with money, but you got to pay for it with your integrity. You got to pay for it with your honesty. You have to pay for it with your popularity. And this is what God is looking for, because this is what Jesus was all about. He acted wisely, and so God's going to raise him up and lift him up and exalt him. But what does it say that the humans are thinking about him? Well, first of all, verse 14 of chapter 52, they're appalled. Because what happened to him at the climax of his life? He let himself be beaten up and scarred and whipped and all kind of things. And people looked at that and you remember what they even said? Oh, the Son of God, right. The Son of God comes down here and he can't even protect himself against a few bullying Romans with a whip. Right. And they lost faith in him because of that. Because they didn't expect the Son of God to do that. They would expect the Son of God to come down and straighten everything out and boss everybody around, get some special privileges so that he can go around and spread his blessings on everybody that was on his team. And that's not what he came to do. He let himself be mistreated. He let that happen. He didn't claim any special privileges. He didn't claim any special rights. And this is not wise by the standards of the world, but it's wise by God. It says, kings will shut their mouths because of him. For what they were not told, they will see, and what they have not heard, they will understand. That even though the world looks at him and just is baffled and confused and doesn't like it, they really don't have an answer to him, to the real Jesus. Now, the fake Jesuses that the world sells, there's easy answers to that. But the real Jesus, it's very hard to answer him, very hard to refute him. When you talk about a Jesus who did come to sacrifice himself to save people from their sins, that's very hard to make fun of, and it's very hard to come up with any kind of real rebuttal of that, because it's so different from the standards of the world. It's something that most people don't even think about. You turn on your news, you listen to the political candidates, you listen to the experts, the professors and everything. They've got all kind of answers for all kind of problems. How do we fix the economy? Well, I think we need to do this, do that, blah, 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 blah. What do we need to do about the crime in our country? Well, we should do this, we should do that, we should do this, blah, blah, blah. They've got all kind of things about that. How are you going to get your sins forgiven? They didn't even thought about that, because it's not important to them. Now, they don't know anything about those other things either, but they've been professionally trained to convince you that they do. But they don't. They know they don't know anything about the forgiveness of sins, and they can't even fake it very well. That's why kings will shut their mouths. Kings and experts and professors can't refute the ministry of Jesus, because they don't even have a mental framework to deal with it. It's something they're not equipped to do. If Jesus had come with a new economic plan, then they could critique it and argue about it and blame people for it. But when Jesus comes to forgive your sins, it's just outside of their intellectual framework, because it's not something that the flesh thinks of as important. And here is why he says, who's believed our message? He grew up like a tender shoot. Now, that's an appropriate expression of Jesus, because he grew up and lived such a pure, innocent, sinless life. And yet there again, turns right around, but he had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. Because the world may give lip service to the fact that, oh yeah, we like people who are innocent and honest and everything, but that's not what we really admire. We really admire who compete and push people around and get to the top. because that's what we want to be like, and so that's the kind of people that we admire. So we may say that we admire the tender shoot growing out of the ground, but in reality, it's a real challenge to really admire Jesus the way that we admire some of our worldly heroes, some of our fleshly heroes. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. Well, here again, that's not something that marketing groups are going to tell you you should do if you want to become a popular public figure. You don't want to go around being a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. That's not very bright. But there's a reason for it, wasn't there? Because he had to do that. He had to come down here. He's the one person in all of history, even if you set aside his sacrifice for the forgiveness of sins, he's the one person in all of history who ever came down and told us what this world is really like. He's the only person who ever came down here and didn't say, I've got a plan to fix all this stuff. Just give me some money and some power and I'll fix it for you. He came down and said, look, here's the way this world is. It's under the control of the evil one. You've all sinned. You all need to be forgiven. None of you can do it yourselves. I'm going to have to go ahead and die for you. He's the one person that ever told you what the world is really like. That there is a lot of crime out there. There is a lot of injustice. There is a lot of oppression. There are a lot of people out there being selfish and violent and materialistic. And that's the way we all are in our fleshly nature. None of us has any business thinking that we're superior to anybody else. Jesus is the one person who told us that. Jesus is the one person that didn't try to pander to one group or another. Say, you guys are the good guys, so you're the ones that I'm going to take care of. And that scum over there, let's just take it out on them. Jesus is the one person that came and told us every one of us has an equal guilt for sin. And every one of us has an equal need for grace, because every one of us is helpless to save ourselves. He's the only person that ever came and told us the truth. He's the only person that ever really believed that everyone's equal. We have a constitution that says that. The guy that wrote it owned slaves, or claimed to own slaves. He claimed the right to own other people's lives. So how much does our country ever really believe that? We don't believe that the president is no more important than a bum on a street corner. We don't believe that. But it's true. It's true to Jesus, and he's the only person who ever lived that. He's the only person who ever came and hung out with drunks and prostitutes and didn't hang around with the big shots. Didn't pander and cater to the big shot so that he could get special privileges. He's the only one who really believed that everyone's equal. And that's why kings have to shut their mouths in the face of Jesus when they're dealing with the real Jesus. When they're dealing with these fake Jesuses, well, they're easy to deal with. The fake Jesuses that just want to go and hassle people who use drugs and hassle people who get abortions and stuff, that's not the real Jesus. The real Jesus believes everyone's equal, everyone has an equal guilt of sin, no one is righteous before God on their own. The real Jesus tells us the truth. That's a hard thing to do, and he suffered for it. He suffered a lot for it. Jesus had a lot of opportunities to make himself real popular, real rich, and real powerful. But he considered them trash. He considered them rubbish. And this is what we're called to do, again, going back to what Isaiah said, which is kind of half on the board and half erased. Depart, go out from there. This is what he's calling us to do. Not to run away from the world, but to change our thinking so that we realize, yeah, this is what the truth is. The truth is I'm no better than anybody else. I need God's grace desperately, and so do all my friends and family and neighbors, and so even to the people that I really think I am superior to or inferior to, because there's not really any such thing. And so we find out, of course, in this next passage, why did he go through all this suffering? Why did he go through this rejection? Well, it was necessary because, here in verse 4 is the key to it all. Because he had to take up our infirmities, he had to carry our sorrows, he had to be smitten, he had to be afflicted because of sin, because of our transgressions, our iniquities. And he uses several words for sin, by the way. That's not supposed to be little fine shades of distinction. It's just for poetic effect. He says, he was pierced for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. He was punished to bring us peace. It's just poetic. It means, think about all the sins, transgressions, iniquities. You want to spend your time deciding which ones were transgressions, which one were iniquities. Well, some commentators do that, and all it does is kill a few extra trees that would be alive today if they hadn't felt the need to expound on all these things. You know the reason why commentators will look at the words iniquities and transgressions and sin and go into detailed analysis of what the difference is between them? It's because, well, as long as they're doing that, they don't have to deal with the fact that they've committed transgressions and iniquities and sin. If they can sit there giving you all this scholarly blather about what the Hebrew words mean, the longer they do that, the longer they can avoid dealing with the real issues. The longer that they can avoid dealing with themselves, and the longer they can get away from telling you, you've got sins and iniquities and transgressions. And of course, in the church, there again. That's the reason why we spend a lot of time arguing about whether or not you're allowed to have an organ in the church. We can spend all day long arguing about that, and it keeps us all from having to deal with the real problem, is that both we and those rebels who use organs in their church, we're all equally lost anyway. We're all equally dependent on God's grace anyway. And as long as we can find things to argue about and make ourselves feel superior, the more time we spend doing that, the less time we got to spend dealing with the real truth. That's why Jesus ended up being crucified. And that's why it's very hard for us to even tell the truth to each other, because you end up becoming very unpopular. You see, I don't have to worry about it. Everyone knows I'm a wacko anyway. You all know better than to believe anything I say anyway. But when I happen to point out something to you that's in the Bible, you really should believe it, even though it was me that pointed out to you. Because if God says it, it's really true. And what God says is, we really have to believe this stuff that we're all equal. We really have to believe this stuff that we all need God's grace. Well, he talks a lot about this. We considered him stricken by God, but there's a reason. He needed to be stricken by God because he's the only one that could serve as a perfect, willing sacrifice for our sins. He voluntarily underwent that. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter. He was cut off from the land of the living. He had to do that. He did it out of love and compassion and mercy. He wasn't motivated by the things we're motivated by in this world. He didn't say, look, if you want me to solve your problems, you've got to give me a lot of special privileges and power, and you're going to need to give me lots of money to work with here. He said, I'm going to deal with your problems. I'm going to deal with your deepest needs. I'm going to let them kill me and crush me. That's what he did. That's what makes Jesus so different from the world. And it also is what really should be convicting to us, how far the real Jesus is from the Jesus we usually preach. Because that's what Jesus really is interested in. He's not interested in a lot of things we worry about and argue about so much as people understanding this and accepting us. And it's also not a question of imitating Jesus outwardly. Because there again, we worry, okay, so what are you telling me I gotta do? I gotta go out somewhere and make people mad so they beat me up or something? Or maybe a little more sophisticated, a lot of times we worry about, well, you know, we've got to imitate these methods. We worry about methods. I heard a church down in Podunk City has this new evangelism method, and they had 200 baptisms last year. Well, good for Podunk City. But that doesn't necessarily mean anything if you're just worried about some program. If your faith is in some program, what are you going to convert people to? A program. If your faith is in some leader, you're just going to convert them to some leader. Now, it's too bad Lloyd's leaving, because I wanted to give an illustration that involves Lloyd. Because I learned this problem with imitating people outwardly at great embarrassment to myself a few months ago. Our small group, which we have the same small group for about 20 years now, over 20 years. Me and Perry Code and Lloyd Snyder started a small group back in the apartment Perry and I shared back in 1986. And small groups come and go as a fad, but we've had a close group together for all these years, and we have a long-standing tradition. After our Bible study on Monday nights, we usually have a game of cards. And more often than not, it's me and Lloyd against Perry and Warren Cote. So we have this regular game of cards. And if you ever played cards with Lloyd, he's a lot of fun. Yeah, because he really takes his cards seriously. Now, it's not as bad as taking goose droppings seriously, but it's funny. It's still just as funny. And Lloyd has some particular phrases that he uses, and when he gets really animated, he tends to have some certain gestures. He slams on the table, and he has some Lloyd Snyder expressions that are uttered simultaneously. Well, we had some new people come. Bob and Ellen started coming to our small group a few months ago, and a couple other people that hadn't been there before, so we were kind of explaining our tradition and explaining what it's like to watch Lloyd play cards. And so Perry and the rest of us were kind of quoting some of Lloyd's favorite expressions. Well, I wanted to show them this Lloyd Snyder gesture. I said, yeah, when something really bad happens to Lloyd during a card game, he slams his hands down on the table and he gives these Lloyd Snyder expressions. Well, here's the thing. That's for you Monk fans. It's really interesting how you can know someone as long as I've known Lloyd and notice a lot of these habits and pick up on a lot of phrases, but never really catch the things that really make a person who they are. Some of the things that really show how skilled Lloyd is in the areas that he's strong in, because I've seen him slam tables year after year after year, and I thought I understood it. I viewed it as just a spontaneous act, but Now I know that Lloyd is really an expert table slammer, because until that night, I never realized that as many hundreds of times as Lloyd slams tables, he never does it when he's got a drink sitting next to him on the table. Now see, if I had known that, I would have saved myself some embarrassment, because when I demonstrated Lloyd's patented table slam, being an amateur at slamming tables, there was a drink sitting next to me on the table, and it went flying. Now, I make a fool of myself on a pretty regular basis, so that didn't really bother me, but it messed up Perry's nice new floor pretty good, so we had to clean it all up, and so I felt pretty awful about it. But that's the problem with imitating people outwardly. See, when something bad happens to me when I play cards, I just make a cynical remark and let it go. I'm an amateur when it comes to slamming the table. So from now on, I'm going to leave slamming the table to Lloyd, and I'll stick to the cynical remarks. When you're trying to follow Jesus, don't follow the outward things. This is my point. Don't just worry about some method, some personality that seems to be, quote, working. Look at Jesus' values and priorities and perspectives, and make your effort, focus your heart on learning those things. Okay, the guy was willing to suffer unpopularity. He was willing to be look foolish in the world's eyes because he believed in things that were more important. He knew that grace outweighed the riches of the world. He knew that mercy and honesty and integrity are more important than getting ahead. He knew it was more important to be forgiven than to be right. He knew it was more important to give something to others instead of grabbing it for himself. Just worry about those things, because those are very powerful. They're a lot more powerful than some trendy new evangelism method. They're a lot more powerful than some new phrase that people came up. They're a lot more popular than some new argument to disprove evolution. They're a lot more popular than some pat answer that you've been taught to give to difficult questions. If we learn to focus on those things and make those part of our thinking in our lives, there's a great deal of other things that you will change without even having to make any special effort to do so. So give some thought to what this says about the nature of Jesus, the nature of us as God's servants, and your relationship with God. We'll try to talk about a little bit more next time. As always, appreciate very much your patience and your endurance, and we'll pick up with some more Isaiah next week. Thanks a lot.